Good afternoon. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Gina Ballaria, Program Manager at the UCF Center for Health Professions and former Lit Director and Assistant Director of Programs here at the Commonwealth Club. It is my pleasure today to introduce Ananya Roy, Education Director at the Blum Center for Developing Economies and Professor in the Department of City and Regional Planning at UC Berkeley. Roy's most recent book is Poverty Capital, Microfinance, and the Making of Development. The research on which this book is based has received many accolades, including the Hellman Faculty Award, the Pratanian Faculty Award, as well as a multi-year research grant from the National Science Foundation. Her primary teaching areas are comparative urban studies and international development. In fact, she has been honored for her teaching several times, including the 2006 Distinguished Faculty Mentors Award, the 2006 Distinguished Teaching Award, the highest honor UC Berkeley bestows on its faculty, and in 2008, she received the Golden Apple Teaching Award, the only teaching award given by the student body. In addition, over the course of her career, Roy has consistently received high accolades from students, including Teacher of the Year, Best Seminar of the Year, Best Lecturer of the Year, and the list goes on. Outside the classroom, of course, Roy's primary projects include efforts to alleviate global poverty through sustainable human development, and that's much of what we'll be talking about today. In addition to Poverty Capital, Roy has authored or co-authored several other books and is in the process of completing Worlding Cities, Asian Experiments in the Art of Being Global, part of her studies in urban and social change. Roy earned her bachelor's in comparative urban studies from Mills College and a master's in city planning and PhD at UC Berkeley. Please welcome Ananya Roy.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's an honor to be here today and to share with you some of my research on the pressing question of persistent poverty around the world. The stark fact that of a world population of 6.7 billion people, 2 billion live presently under conditions of poverty, 1.4 billion of whom live under the unimaginable conditions of earning less than $1.25 a day, has now become a global common sense. But the start of the new millennium has also been marked by the emergence of a remarkable global conscience, the awareness of global poverty, and the articulation of the will to end poverty. The Millennium Development Goals, ratified by the United Nations in 2000, today serve as a global social contract, tracking progress on a set of ambitious indicators that include the reduction of maternal mortality, universal primary school enrollment, and better access to clean water and sanitation. There are iconic figures that loom large in the millennial moment, leading the massive global campaigns to end poverty. The Gates, who have built the world's largest foundation, to my favorite millennial figure, the aging rock star Bono. Bono insists that we could be the first generation to outlaw the kind of extreme, stupid poverty that sees a child die of hunger in a world of plenty. But what is perhaps most striking about this millennial moment is that the global conscience about poverty is widely owned. So, for example, the One campaign prides itself on being the campaign of everyday people. Indeed, what we are witnessing is nothing less than what I would call the democratization of development. The sense that the project of international development may no longer simply be the work of powerful development institutions such as the World Bank or USAID or the United Nations. It is now the concern of a wide swath of everyday Americans, everyday Europeans. This is the appeal of something like Product Red, in addition, of course, to the appeal of the One campaign. Product Red allows everyday consumers to participate in the struggle against AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis through their purchase of luxury commodities. In other words, it empowers us to participate in the endeavor to make poverty history. This democratization of development is evident on university campuses as well. Yesterday was the first day of classes at UC Berkeley, where I teach, and the Blum Center's course on global poverty was in Cal's largest classroom, the Wheeler Auditorium, which has over 700 seats, except that we had 1,000 students there wanting to take a class on global poverty. This is the millennial generation, and I'll talk later today about how they have sought to make global poverty their issue. But today I want to first share with you a broad overview of different pathways of poverty alleviation that are evident in different parts of the world. Some of these findings come from the research that I conducted from my recently completed book, Poverty Capital, Microfinance, and the Making of Development, which will be published by Routledge in a few months. While the book takes a closer look at one of the most popular instruments of poverty alleviation, microfinance, it is also about a much larger story of development. I completed the book just as the effects of the financial crisis were becoming evident around the world. Already a food crisis with sharp increases in food prices had swelled the ranks of the poor. The financial crisis only threatens to make things worse. The United Nations has now issued the dire warning that millions will be pushed into deeper poverty, and that this in turn will lead to the deaths of thousands of children. That in sub-Saharan Africa, there will be a 20% decline in per capita income. The World Bank noted that just in the year 2008, higher food prices added about 155 million people to the ranks of the poor. Now the financial crisis is likely to add 46 million to these numbers in 2009. A decade of poverty alleviation is thus being reversed. Of particular concern is whether or not industrialized nations will meet their aid commitments. At the moment, with the exception of countries such as Norway, most of the industrialized countries do not live up to the mandate of the Millennium Development Goals, which is to allocate 0.7% of their gross domestic product to overseas aid. Now, that's a tiny figure, 0.7%. But for most countries, including the US, the figures are much lower, about 0.15% of GDP, which is allocated to overseas development assistance. So in a recent editorial, World Bank President Robert Zoellick called for an age of responsibility, for responsible globalization, responsible multilateralism, and financial responsibility. That language of responsibility is interesting because the financial crisis itself has been diagnosed as an instance of bad money, reckless greed, and quite a bit of irresponsibility on Wall Street. In his book, The White Man's Burden, William Easterly slams those such as Jeffrey Sachs who make the case for the government role in the alleviation of poverty. There's a famous line in Easterly's book that reads, "The rich have markets, the poor have bureaucrats." Easterly argues that if the poor are incorporated into global markets, then all will be well, that free markets can end poverty, bureaucrats cannot. But the financial crisis and the bailouts that followed revealed something else. I would argue that we can rephrase Easterly thus, "The rich have state help, the poor have self-help." I will also argue later today that such forms of self-help are inadequate to end poverty, that we need more robust interventions, whether those are interventions by the state or by other types of institutions. One important self-help instrument is microfinance, the practice of giving tiny loans to the very poor. I'm sure I don't have to explain microfinance to this audience. In my book, I examine the ways in which microfinance is now being positioned as subprime lending, as a resilient and successful subprime sector that can reach the poor through a proven formula of lending to poor women. As the American subprime housing market has collapsed, so new attention is being paid to these techniques of lending that have been perfected in some of the poorest countries of the world, such as Bangladesh. There are pressing questions to be asked. Will microfinance remake subprime lending as a system based on trust and social relations, giving dignity to the poor, which is the claim of Mohamed Yunus and the Grameen Bank? Or will microfinance become an industry of micro-sharks, a type of predatory lending with sky-high interest rates? This is currently the big battle for the soul of microfinance, and thus the title of my book, Poverty Capital. Let me now turn briefly to how microfinance and related poverty interventions are playing out in different parts of the world, and I'll start with the Middle East. 9/11 launched not only a war on terror, but also a renewed war on poverty. In an important 2000 essay titled Weapons of Mass Salvation, Jeffrey Sachs argued that alongside the eradication of weapons of mass destruction, there has to be a distribution of what he called weapons of mass salvation. Anti-AIDS drugs, anti-malarial bed nets, bore wells for safe drinking water, and the like. Microfinance is viewed by many as an important weapon of mass salvation. In the words of former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, as a proven tool with macro benefits. In Egypt, which is one of the largest recipients of American aid in the Middle East, USAID and other donors have promoted microfinance quite aggressively as a way to combat Egypt's most persistent problem, which is the unemployment of its educated youth. Yet my research demonstrates some of the great challenges that haunt American-style development in Egypt. Let me just list two. First, Western donors have pumped quite a bit of money into Egypt, specifically into something called the Social Fund, which is meant to allow the poor and the low-income middle class to set up micro-enterprises. A high-level USAID official I interviewed in Washington, D.C., put it this way. We are under pressure to give loans to these young men. We are being told that either these young men will utilize these loans and start their own businesses, that they will sell falafel, or they will all become suicide bombers. But it's not so easy to jumpstart an economy. One of the main causes of Egypt's high unemployment rate has to do with the shrinkage of public employment. It is the public sector that guaranteed lifelong desk jobs, still the sort of job that a young, educated Egyptian aspires to have. Microfinance can never generate those sorts of jobs. It can only allow the creation of informal jobs that are fraught with economic uncertainty. And microfinance was meant to solve the problems of poor, usually uneducated women, married women, in the dense villages of Bangladesh. Can that policy now also solve the problems of educated young men on the Arab street? Perhaps not. Second, Egypt is a cornerstone of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. It is estimated that since 1975, Egypt has received over $50 billion in U.S. largesse. Surely such money can make a dent in poverty and unemployment. But let's take a closer look at those figures. Of the $50 billion channeled to Egypt between 1975 and 2005, $39 billion was in military aid, a sum which amounts to 80% of Egypt's military budget. Such military aid quite literally buys the U.S. access to Egypt's airspace and allows the utilization of Egyptian security forces for the various programs that are a part of the U.S. war on terror, programs such as Extraordinary Rendition. And the term aid deserves closer scrutiny. The military aid from the U.S. to Egypt is made up exclusively of something called foreign military financing, FMF grants, which are congressionally appropriated funds that bankroll purchases of advanced combat hardware. By law, by U.S. law, FMF monies must be spent on American-made weaponry, making such arrangements extremely profitable for U.S. defense companies. Indeed, Egypt often buys weaponry on credit, far exceeding the allocation of FMF monies. So what seems to be aid turns out not only to be a purchase of American commodities, but also a purchase financed through credit. And the rest of this aid also ends up being spent for the most part here in the US on services ranging from construction to consulting. The economic assistance provided by USAID to Egypt, that massive $50 billion figure, turns out to be, as one commentator puts it, a form of state support to the American corporate sector while working in Egypt to dismantle state supports. This aid, some have argued, has created a crippling dependence of Egypt on imports of American food, machinery, and technology. This, I would argue, is the performance of development rather than development itself. And the story seems rather hopeless. But there are instances in the Middle East where development works. And one such case is Lebanon. But the catch is that the main development agency in Lebanon is Hezbollah, the Shia militia and political party that is known both for its religious orthodoxy and its organized violence. I'm sure this audience remembers the summer of 2006 when the world witnessed a new round of war between Israel and Lebanon, but the war, in fact, was between Israel and Hezbollah. The war also provided a crucial glimpse into the ways in which Hezbollah has emerged as the de facto state in southern Lebanon and in the southern suburbs of Beirut. Founded in 1984, Hezbollah, or the Party of God, is the maturation of a religious militia. High on the US's list of terrorist organizations, Hezbollah is a military force, but it is also now a political party with representation in the Lebanese government. In addition, Hezbollah manages a vast social welfare and development apparatus. So since its inception, Hezbollah has operated two sets of development institutions, those that provide services to targeted beneficiaries, widows, families of martyrs, etc., and those that have a broad scope of service provision. These include organizations such as Jihad al-Bina, which is Jihad for Construction, Al-Amdad, the Resource, the Islamic Society for Health, and Al-Qard al-Hassan, or the Good Loan. Al-Qard al-Hassan is Hezbollah's microfinance program, which has about 40,000 clients and is hands down the largest microfinance organization in the Middle East, far outstripping any microfinance organizations established by other institutions, including USAID. Microfinance is an important strategy for Hezbollah, promising to foster economic independence and transformation for Hezbollah followers. So in this context, in Lebanon, and more broadly in the Middle East, where development NGOs for the most part seem to be artifacts of foreign aid, Hezbollah seems to be the genuinely native and local institution of development. In an interview that I conducted, a top Hezbollah official spoke as to how Hezbollah is inside communities. He said, "We are part of the community. We know and understand the needs of the people. No one can match us." Hezbollah thus seems to be the alternative to Egypt's development story. Yet Hezbollah's military, charity, and development activities rely highly on Syria and Iran for funding. The various NGOs established by Hezbollah in Lebanon, at least in their initial years, were directly controlled by Iran and were in fact an example of Iranian foreign policy in Lebanon, what many Lebanese see as Iranian intervention and interference in their country. In Lebanon, like Egypt, we then possibly see a similar composition of dependence and control. I want to contrast these Middle East cases with a very different story of development, this one emerging from Bangladesh. Bangladesh, of course, is known as the home of microfinance. In 2006, Mohammed Yunus and the Grameen Bank were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for their work. Most recently, something unusual has been afoot in Bangladesh. It has come to be called the Bangladesh paradox, that one of the world's poorest countries, plagued by natural disaster and by political instability, has made massive improvements in human development. These improvements include declines in poverty, in maternal mortality, and sharp improvements in children's education and the access of the poor to various types of infrastructure. Such achievements are being credited, even by the World Bank, to a set of NGOs, including the Grameen Bank. These institutions are known for their microfinance work, but what I discovered in my research is they do much more than microfinance, and that story needs to be told. Now, I should note that we're talking about a quite incredible scale of institutions in Bangladesh. The most well-known is the Grameen Bank, but equally important is the story of BRAC. BRAC, which started as a small-scale rehabilitation project in 1972, today has a staff of 40,000 full-time staff and 160,000 paraprofessional staff, 72% of whom are women. BRAC's microfinance program serves 6 million women. Its schools serve 3 million children, and this is a rather stunning figure. Its health program reaches over 100 million people in rural Bangladesh. My research shows that there are three secrets to the Bangladesh paradox, to how and why poverty alleviation is working in one of the poorest countries in the world. And whether we like it or not, that secret is not microfinance. First, the Bangladesh institutions focus on asset building and service delivery for the poor. The formal term for this is social protection. It is thus that the Grameen Bank makes it possible for some of the poorest women in the world to own their own homes. Second, these institutions create a development infrastructure that spans much of rural Bangladesh. BRAC's work is an example of this. BRAC, through sectors such as dairy and poultry, are able to connect the micro-enterprises of the poor to the national and global economy. Such infrastructures do not replace the role of the state, but they put pressure on the state to step up and provide services, particularly in education and health. And without such infrastructure, the micro-enterprises of the poor are just that, micro-enterprises, informal, vulnerable, and with meager economic value. Third, and this may come as a surprise, the key to these anti-poverty programs is not credit. Despite all of the talk of the Grameen Bank that credit is a human right, the key turns out to be savings. These institutions encourage and indeed force the poor to save. These savings allow the poor to manage risk. If we think of poverty, as one anthropologist has put it, as the tyranny of emergency, then the value of a savings-focused approach is evident. Now, these institutions embody a rather unique history of development, one where in the context of the struggle for independence in the early 1970s, there was the emergence of an educated nationalist class, men such as Fazal Abad and Muhammad Yunus, who became actively engaged in the creation and management of organizations that served the poor. It is perhaps a history that is difficult to replicate elsewhere. I also wanted to make the point that the Bangladesh paradox today exists in sharp contrast to Bangladesh's economic superpower neighbor, India. India has enjoyed brisk economic growth, and while the government of India claims sharp drops in poverty in India, it turns out that India's poverty line is better understood as a starvation line. It's about 40 cents. And one can argue that a poor person in India can survive on 40 cents a day. One can argue also that a poor person in India can barely survive on 40 cents a day. When the $2 a day international poverty line is applied to India, about 70% of the Indian population, or about 800 million people, are found to be poor. The world's largest democracy is, in fact, what one Indian scholar has called the Republic of Hunger. Now, Bangladesh is not unique in its experiments with social protection. In Latin America, for example, in Mexico and Brazil, social protection programs are very much now on the agenda. The most well-known are conditional cash transfers, programs that make small payments to poor households, but with conditions that mandate various social development outcomes, such as sending children to school, visits to health clinics, and so forth. One such program is Mexico's Oportunidades program, which was earlier known as Progresa. Aimed primarily at women, the program is credited with substantial decreases in poverty in Mexico. A similar program in Brazil is the Bolsa Familia. Now, conditional cash transfer programs have their own share of critics. But my Berkeley colleagues, Alain de Genvry and Elizabeth Sadoulet, have argued that such programs are an experiment with social democracy. They're an example of a new set of social contracts with the poor. Indeed, the Stanford anthropologist Jim Ferguson sees such social protection programs as what he calls a citizen's income, one that acknowledges a kind of nationwide membership and solidarity that would include rights to basic subsistence and consumption. A flat citizen's income, earned as a right, is perhaps a radical concept. It's a radical concept here in this country, and a sharp departure from the American welfare state, where support for the poor is seen not as a right, but instead as fostering dependence. It is also a departure from other Latin American contexts where poverty alleviation programs seem to be high on the agenda. So one such context is Venezuela, where there has been a lot of optimism about Chavez's efforts to reduce poverty. Chavez, when he came to power, declared that he was going to launch a project that he called oil socialism, that he was going to use the oil revenues to direct money to poor neighborhoods. And his administration established a variety of anti-poverty initiatives, including bringing doctors over from Cuba to staff health clinics in the poorest neighborhoods of Venezuelan cities. But a closer look shows that such oil socialism has turned out to be what I've been calling petropopulism, serving favored segments of the poor. It is a machinery of selective patronage, where the spending of these funds are at the discretion of a vast fund that Chavez himself controls, and where some segments of the poor receive that patronage and others, those who are not Chavez supporters, do not. That story of patronage is common in many parts of the world, and that is a diminished citizenship, one where the poor are included, but only as paupers who must rely on patrons. The social protection programs that some of us are trying to study and that have caused so much optimism are quite different because they are about universal access. They're about the idea of a citizen's income. Now, I hope I've given you an outline, at least, of some interesting global trends, stories of failed development, as well as some that surprise and inspire. But as I mentioned at the start of today's presentation, there's another story that attends this millennial moment, and that is the democratization of development, a sense of its widespread ownership by a millennial generation. At my home campus, at UC Berkeley, such energy is palpable. I have the good fortune to be affiliated with the Blum Center for Developing Economies, which is committed to finding real-world solutions for poverty. Notable about the center is the hundreds of undergraduate students who have signed up for its curriculum, an undergraduate minor in global poverty in practice, and students who are crafting their own forms of global engagement. Earlier this year, Vice President Al Gore celebrated the work of the Center and the Minor and talked about these young men and women as weavers. He said that when the fabric of a society and world is frayed, the role of a university and of young university students is to weave it back together. So let me, as I wrap up today's presentation, briefly share with you some examples of this weaving. I've talked to you today about the Middle East. Here's a story about an effort to craft change in the interstices of dependence and violence in the Middle East. The story is that of one of my undergraduate students, Daniel Zugby, who is now at Oxford University on a Marshall Scholarship, doing a graduate degree in development studies. In his senior year at Cal, Daniel had an idea for a project. He'd grown up in the Palestinian territories and had watched the healthcare system collapse under conditions of war and curfew. In fact, his grandmother had died of complications from diabetes because of lack of access to healthcare. In his class at Cal, he researched this situation, studying the sad fact of preventable deaths around the world, studying how in the Palestinian territories an overburdened United Nations tries to provide healthcare. But he wanted to do something about it as well. And so in his senior year, Daniel headed to Bethlehem, setting up 50 microclinics, each a community-owned and managed healthcare center where people share glucose monitoring devices, check for diabetes and blood sugar, and more generally take charge of their own health, especially under conditions of curfew and restricted mobility. Aware of the large numbers of educated but unemployed youth, Daniel also mobilized local university students as volunteers, thereby connecting different generations and connecting youth to their communities. This was not just an infrastructure of low-cost, low-barrier health. It was also an infrastructure of peace. Today, barely out of his teenage years, Daniel is the founder and director of his own international organization, the Global Microclinic Project, that is running similar microclinics in different parts of the Middle East and has been recently tasked by the International Diabetes Foundation to expand their work to Jordan. At UC Berkeley, Daniel's project is housed in the Blum Center, and it now funds a new generation of UC Berkeley undergraduates as they go out and do this work in poor communities around the world. A second example comes from a different context, from Rwanda, and it is the work of a student in the Global Poverty in Practice minor, Jacob Siegel Botner, who has been working with an organization called Project Rwanda. And this example gives you a sense of the importance of that infrastructure, that value-added infrastructure that I mentioned in the context of Bangladesh. Project Rwanda seeks to further the economic development of Rwanda through initiatives based on the bicycle as a tool and symbol of hope. Jacob works on something called the coffee bike. Why is that important? Well, Rwanda has nearly 500,000 smallholder coffee producers. There's tremendous potential here for high-value specialty coffee. In other words, for these coffee producers to get a decent price for their coffee on global markets. I'm sure you already know this. Coffee is one of the world's most heavily traded commodities, second only to oil. It's an $80 billion global industry, and yet the farmers who actually produce the coffee beans are some of the lowest paid, lowest remunerated workers on the face of this earth. The challenge that Rwanda's coffee farmers face is how to transport their coffee cherries to washing stations and processing plants, because that infrastructure, for example, transportation networks, are simply missing. So, in fact, farmers often have to wait for 12 hours at a washing station for a truck to pick up their coffee cherries and transport it to the next stop. And for each hour that these coffee cherries sit there, they lose value, and farmers get a lower price for their coffee. The coffee bike changes this by creating a bike that the farmers can use to transport their coffees, one that can navigate Rwanda's hilly terrain, one that can train local villagers to be bike mechanics, and one that can even provide forms of financing so that these bikes can, in fact, be purchased by coffee farmers. Jacob, a bike enthusiast, has been doing this work in Rwanda. He calls it the Wheels of Hope, and he recently produced a short documentary called Pascal's Bike about how one of these coffee farmers came to use such a coffee bike. It's important to note that the millennial generation does not undertake this work naively. It undertakes this work with optimism, but not with naivete. I'm always amazed at how UC Berkeley students are able to occupy what I have been calling is an impossible space between the hubris of benevolence, and that is the idea that Americans can save the world, and the paralysis of cynicism, the sense that nothing can be done. The world cannot be changed. Our global poverty in practice minor is this impossible space. As one of our students recently put it, it is a way of naming the gap between our lives of privilege and the lives of deprivation and impoverishment. This student, Emma Shaw Crane, recently graduated from UC Berkeley, and she also gave Berkeley's convocation address since she was a recipient of the University Medal, the highest academic honor the campus confers on a graduating senior. In a convocation speech, Emma drew attention to issues of poverty, not elsewhere, not in the third world, but here at home. And I wanted to end by sharing some of her words. She said, "The week I received this award, two young men I knew were shot and killed a few miles from the campus, where, because they were black and poor, they lived a world apart. Their names were Larry and Maurice. Their murders hardly made the news, because in this country, there is nothing uncommon about the unnecessary death of young African-American men. I celebrated the honor of my graduation, knowing their families were drowning in grief." Emma's work in the Global Poverty in Practice Minor was with young, poor, at-risk black men such as Larry and Maurice in a continuation program called the BTEC Academy, a mile or so away from UC Berkeley and yet a world apart. Emma asked us not to look away, to face up to that gap, to occupy that impossible space. She and Daniel and Jacob and many others embody what I believe is key to the millennial generation, an ethics of global citizenship. It allows them to imagine relationships of reciprocity with those who are a continent away or just a mile away, to weave a new fabric of habitation, solidarity, and responsibility. For me, this is a matter of great hope. Thank you.
Our thanks to Ananya Roy for her comments today, and thank you also to the audience for the questions that have arrived so far. So we were about to begin. Based on what you were talking about at the end of your speech, many people want to help. But they have so much to deal with in their own lives, and many people just feel cynical, or that there's nothing that can be done, or why should I? How can an everyday average person contribute to global change?
I think one of the beauties of the moment that we live in is the democratization of development, the sense that we have the opportunity to participate in ways of changing the world. And I think that there are different routes. I think for the young men and women I see in my classroom, their preferred route is to immerse themselves in the work of organizations and communities. Mm-hmm. And I think they do this not with the idea that they have the silver bullet and they're going to somehow in 8 weeks or 3 months solve the world's problems, but rather that they want to learn more about those communities. They recognize often that they will get much more than they can give, but that too is part of the process of making change. But I think more broadly, as global citizens and as citizens of this country, we have the opportunity through the choices we make to make a difference. And that relates not only to choices around consumption, not just what we choose to buy, be it fair trade coffee or product from Product Red, but also the choices that we allow our elected representatives to make. So, for example, the agricultural subsidies that remain in place in North America, Western Europe, and Japan have a devastating impact on poor farmers around the world. Mm-hmm. Well, those are choices that we have made as a country and choices that we can possibly recalibrate.
And that leads directly into my next question. Change is often met with great resistance, inertia, and sometimes violence. So how do you, I think that the ideas are incredible and people are doing great work, but how do you take on the government? How do you get in there and really push the direction of that philosophy a different way?
I think that one of the big shifts that happened in this larger project of international development in the 1990s was a new sense of political opening. That if the 1980s were all about the ideology of the free market, then in the 1990s we saw a proliferation of social movements. Some of these were local, some came out of places like Chiapas, but others were global social movements. Seattle was one expression of that great energy where different interests came together around the idea of reforming global governance. And I think that there is an energy, there is a sense that change is possible. The motto of the World Social Forum is that another world is possible. And yet, I don't think we can be naive about it. I do think we need to think about the structurally embedded nature of these processes and the work that this will take. In this country, the financial crisis may be a political opening. I think clearly for young men and women, President Obama's election feels like a political opening. But a few months ago, Frank Rich had an interesting column in the New York Times where he talked about the financial crisis as a financial Katrina. Is this going to be President Obama's financial Katrina? But what he meant by that was that Katrina itself was a searing moment. It exposed poverty, and it galvanized, at least for a moment, this country. Will this financial crisis do something similar?
Okay. There's a question from the audience. How, given the fact that there's so much poverty both globally and here in the U.S., why should U.S. citizens spend their time and spend their money on other countries before solving poverty here or other issues here?
I wouldn't necessarily argue that U.S. citizens have to spend their money or their energy on problems elsewhere rather than here. What I would call into question is that distinction between here and elsewhere. I think we live in a world where those distinctions do not make sense anymore. It is very difficult to say, well, that the BTEC Academy a mile away from the Berkeley campus is here, because clearly the opportunities and resources that exist in the BTEC Academy are similar to the most desperate parts of the Global South rather than anything that we are used to in our worlds of privilege. But I also think we live in an interconnected world, and I think it's unfortunate that it took 9/11 to bring home those interconnections and to create a sense of urgency to make change. I think the financial crisis has once again made evident the interconnected nature of our world.
Have you already seen through either your students or the organizations you work with any sort of shift in philosophy because of the financial downturn?
I think that organizations are struggling in the context of the financial crisis and trying to figure out how best one can deal with the growing numbers of the poor as well as diminished resources. But I think there's been an interesting shift in the vocabulary of everyday Americans around the financial crisis. So my colleague at Berkeley, Robert Reich, has been writing in his blog about socialized capitalism, saying we need to question the massive bailout and we need to think about how and why this sort of state help is not available to the middle class or to the poor. And I think there's been an interesting discussion and interrogation of the distribution of resources triggered by the financial crisis.
Mm-hmm. Are there other countries that you've worked with or studied that handle things like healthcare or distribution of resources more effectively than the United States?
Well, clearly there are many other countries in the industrialized world that have a better track record on these issues. In fact, if one looks at the Human Development Index, which is put out by the United Nations, the U.S. doesn't fare very well on it. It's about number 7 on that list. So we can clearly do a much better job. But I think that there are important lessons to be learned even from the poorest countries. From Bangladesh, for example, where in fact with quite limited resources, there is the provision of a massive infrastructure now of healthcare and of education in rural Bangladesh. I think Brazil and Mexico, with its conditional cash transfers, with these social protection programs, offer important lessons. This idea of a citizen's income, that if you, in fact, fall below a certain threshold, you are guaranteed a basic income that at least allows you to subsist. And for that income, you don't have to beg and plead. It is part of your citizenship. It is a right that you have.
So there are a couple questions from the audience relating to that concept. In the U.S., as you mentioned in your talk, many see it as a, perpetuating
dependence.
Thank you, perpetuating yes. dependence, and that people who are able to get this welfare, maybe a percentage of them will live off it and not go and work because they've got the money coming in. And sometimes it's actually a situation where they're going to make less going to work. Mm-hmm. So how do you respond to arguments such as that, where, why would we set up a welfare state? Why, this is just perpetuating dependence and it's just allowing these people not to work.
So two responses to that. One, we have a welfare state. I think the question that Bob Reich asked, well, welfare for whom, right? The massive subsidies that our state and other states provide to its citizens. If you look at the arena of housing, the real public housing policy in this country is not what we call public housing that we're now dismantling. The real public housing are the tax deductions that are provided to homeowners on their mortgages. That's a massive subsidy. And it's a subsidy that many of us enjoy. Our highway systems, our purchase of cars, these are all subsidized. Those are forms of welfare, if you will. I think what the financial crisis has done has set into motion a debate about how and why these subsidies are made available often to the rich and not to other Americans. But the second response to that question about the welfare state is that countries that have social protection programs that provide support in dignified ways to the poor have not seen a situation where the poor choose not to work, but in fact have seen communities that thrive, communities that count on a certain basic level of subsistence. So I think this is one of those great American myths around dependence and a great anxiety about the behavior of the poor and the culture of poverty. And I think one of the valuable lessons from the so-called third world is that these are myths, these are fictions that we can perhaps set aside.
Okay. There's a question here from the audience. What is your thought on the trend that big companies, GE, Philips, et cetera, start businesses for the poor, taking advantage of their size, their resources, et cetera? Is making profit from the poor a good movement ever, a good thing to do ever?
That's a great question, because alongside the democratization of development, we're also seeing what I've been calling the democratization of capital. The argument of folks such as C.K. Prahlad has been that it is possible to make profit and eradicate poverty. So his quite famous book is called The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid, and these have come to be known as bottom of the pyramid strategies, that multinational corporations can serve the poor, make profits, but in fact the poor, because they are now getting access to a new set of services or commodities, are also being served. This is the big debate in the field of microfinance, because there's a whole segment of bottom of the pyramid businesses, if you will, that charge quite high interest rates to the poor as they provide them with financial services. So the Mexican organization Compartamos charges about 90% interest rates as it lends to poor women, and it makes a healthy profit of about $80 million a year. Is that serving the poor and making profits? Compartamos would say yes. They're financially sustainable. It's a great business. They had an IPO where they, in fact, were able to make quite a bit of profit. Muhammad Yunus has responded by saying that absolutely not. This is exploitative. This is the poverty business. This is an example of the poor having to pay a lot more for everything and big corporations now exploiting the poor. I think the jury is still out, and I think we're going to see very different models of these bottom-of-the-pyramid strategies.
Is there any way that you would consider leaning, like if you were involved?
So I think that the subprime crisis gives us, provides us with an important cautionary note. The idea of a subprime loan is a simple one. It is a loan that is not offered to prime customers, but it's only offered to customers who are seen as high risk. The poor are seen as high risk. So the poor now have access, but they have access on a very different set of terms. So subprime consumers pay much higher interest rates on their loans than those who are getting prime loans or normal loans. So, as one of my colleagues puts it, the poor having been redlined or having been excluded from services are now being included, but they are being included on these very segmented terms where they're paying much more for everything that we pay for. Is that justice? I don't think it is. I think we need to transform the ways in which these markets work. So if subprime markets are the only hope we have for the financial inclusion of the poor, I don't think that's good enough.
Okay. I want to take it international again. Talk a little bit about the world's women. There was a recent article in the New York Times, an incredible article. If you haven't read it, look it up, about women and about the fact that there's this very collective sort of understanding now that you have to target women in order to improve the lives of a community or a region. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that. Why have women become the focus? You talked a little bit about it earlier. And how is this? I've only read stories where women are becoming successful and the men in their lives are okay with it. Has there been any pushback from the male population? What's going on?
Okay. There is a great deal of interest in empowering poor women. And of course, this is one of the key themes in microfinance. Microfinance programs, for the most part, lent to women. The argument of poverty intervention, such as microfinance, or even the conditional cash transfers that focus primarily on women, has been twofold. First, that women are vulnerable. They are often more poor than men. So that there are studies that indicate that women are the global underclass. They're disproportionately poor, and that women-headed households are disproportionately poor compared to male-headed households. But the other argument has been that women spend the money better than men. That, in fact, if one looks at development money that goes into a household, women, who, when they control the money, will spend this for the most part on the education of children, on household investments, and men will spend this money on themselves. Now, one can argue that these two are fictions, but they have become quite enduring fictions that now guide programs. And it turns out that women also pay back their loans. They are willing to participate in community activities. So I'm not calling into question the success of women-oriented programs. And I think part of that success has to do with a whole set of intangible factors. The ways in which women are now politically empowered in these communities. I mean, clearly we're seeing that in Bangladesh, where the poorest women are owning homes and running for electoral office, etc. But feminist scholars have been calling into question the burdens that these programs may place on women. And they're talking about not so much the feminization of poverty as the feminization of poverty policy. Asking whether or not, by asking women to do so much, we are placing yet another set of responsibilities on women. And this is being called the third shift or the fourth shift. That if the first shift is the wage-earning work that women do and the second shift is that they take care of their households, are we creating a third shift of community development or microfinance where women are taking on more and more? And what does that then mean for gender justice?
And it's interesting, if you take a look at the U.S., and I'm not quite sure how much it relates, but in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, when African-American men were unable to get jobs, it's the women who went out into the workforce. And you might be able to take a look at sort of how the community, the African-American populations in the U.S. have fared based on that to extrapolate what may happen or may not. So here's a question from the audience. Your explanation of Egyptian foreign aid seems to be a variation of the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Does the bad generally outweigh any good from these established so-called world organizations such as the World Bank, etc.?
It is difficult, in fact, to make generalizations about organizations such as the World Bank. I think it's tempting to make generalizations. I think the World Bank is a complicated institution and there are multiple agendas within it. And I think we've seen quite different moments of the World Bank. So under Jim Wolfensohn, the World Bank was transformed to be an institution more focused on issues of poverty. And it was quite similar to a much earlier moment of the World Bank, the McNamara World Bank. So I think that there are important shifts in World Bank policies, and believe it or not, we can often drive those shifts. Clearly, the shifts that came in the 1990s were the World Bank's response to global social movements. But going back to the most specific part of the question, which is about Egypt, I think that the Egypt story shows us how it is not enough to simply press for more aid, which has been the focus of many campaigns, to ask for industrialized nations to step up and provide more aid. And it's one of the big forms of mobilizations that have been taking place in the context of the financial crisis, to ask rich countries to give more money for aid. I don't think that's enough, because so much depends on the kinds of aid. And when you deconstruct the aid going to a place like Egypt, not only is so much of it devoted to military aid, but so much of it is devoted to supporting companies here in the U.S.
Do you think, is it realistic to assume that poverty can be alleviated? Is there a spectrum that exists, or do you think that everyone can be brought above that line?
I think it is difficult to make a case that poverty can be eradicated. I think what is also at stake is inequality, not just poverty. We clearly have a situation in countries such as China, for example, where there have been important drops in poverty, that there are also increases in inequality. And that is a much more difficult issue to tackle. One of the lessons I learned in Bangladesh, though, it was to be not that focused on the poverty line and to be not that focused on how many people cross the poverty line. I think we tend, in our global generalizations, to focus quite a bit on, well, how many people moved out of poverty and have there been drops in poverty and what does the poverty rate look like? And what I learned in Bangladesh from the work of these organizations was the detailed attention they pay to the lives and stories of the poor, to whether or not a poor woman feels that because of a program, she now has the ability to speak up a bit more or to eat one more meal in a household where she may not be the most powerful member, or where she talks about how she only owned one sari that she would have to wash and wear every day, and she now has two, or she can now use a bar of soap to bathe with. And those organizations taught me that often when we go in as researchers or as consultants, we tend to trivialize those changes because they don't show up in our poverty statistics. And yet for these organizations, those are the changes that matter.
There are some questions here from the audience about overpopulation, about global warming, and how those things might impact poverty.
So I didn't take on the issue of climate change today. I think climate change is crucial. Some of the Blum Center's new work is around the intersection of climate change and poverty. The new Human Development Report put out by the United Nations also looks at this issue. There are many dimensions to that relationship between climate change and poverty, all the way from food security to the fate of countries like Bangladesh and the river deltas that, in fact, are quite low-lying areas of the world. So those are massive issues, and I think they're going to have to be tackled in the coming years and with great urgency.
Do you have an outlook over the next 5 years as far as the work you're doing and where it might lead?
So I'm very optimistic about the work that is going on at a place like UC Berkeley. I know this is not the time to be optimistic about anything in the UC system as sort of our great public universities struggle with their budgets. But I'm optimistic because of this new generation that have been called the millennials. I think their work provides us with a new sort of hope and a hope about how this generation will find a way in the world and how they will find a way for Americans to be in the world. But in terms of the broader story of development, I'm not going to do any forecasting, but I will say that I'm optimistic about the great debates that are going on and about the democratization of development. You know, when I was first starting as an undergraduate student, when we studied development, we studied the World Bank and we studied USAID and we studied those great edifices in Washington, D.C. I don't think that's true anymore. I think nonprofit organizations, non-governmental organizations, and more generally, thousands of young men and women are changing that and are making development their issue.
And as a professor, I want to ask you a question. You see students come in and out your doors 24/7. Does this generation right now think differently than the way maybe we're both in our 30s? And do they think maybe a little differently than the way we may have thought collectively? And if so, how is that thinking different?
I think that that our generation was perhaps much more cynical about the international project of development and what could and could not be done. I think that this generation is far more willing to experiment with different forms of development, and I think that they're able to forge new institutional models. So when I gave you Daniel's example, I think that was an instance of a young man saying, well, I don't like the way in which this works. I'm going to experiment with a different institutional model. And I think we're seeing that repeatedly, the efforts to craft different forms of solidarity or institutions are mobilizing that are unanticipated and that are not part of the usual matrix.
So I have a question from the audience. This is not my question. If a mid-career professional wanted to pursue a passion for ending global poverty and contributing to this cause, where should they look? What organizations should they get involved in, either work, volunteer?
There are so many, and I don't want to come up with a list of great organizations. We do list some organizations on our website, but there are many, and I think that there are many different sectors of work, all the way from health to microfinance.
Okay, great. And then someone else wants to know a little bit about the specific work the Blum Center is doing.
So the Blum Center for Developing Economies currently does work in three areas. Renewable energy for the poor, for example, how do we design better cook stoves that can serve some of the poorest communities? Some of the first projects in that area took place in refugee camps in Darfur. A second area is safe water and sanitation. How do we create affordable, accessible water purification devices for communities in countries where access to safe water is an urgent issue? And again, some of our faculty and students have been working all the way from slums in India to rural areas in Mexico. And a third is the use of wireless technologies to improve access to health services. This work has taken place for the most part in Uganda. But there is more work happening along similar lines in India. An emerging area is the work around climate change and poverty.
Okay, great. One other quick question from the audience, and then I have a final wrap-up question. From the audience, given the collapse of the financial market, can you talk about the growing interest in social capital markets, and what do we need to do to get there? What will it take?
There is quite a bit of interest in other types of markets. I'm not sure whether social capital markets here refers to socially responsible investing.
Not sure. It was very general.
So, you know, there are SRI markets, socially responsible investing, and those markets are quite huge. In fact, there's now a huge market around microfinance. There are massive microfinance investment funds, most of which are headquartered in Europe, and quite a bit of that investing is socially screened. There's also a growing world of Islamic finance that has similar sorts of social screens. So we're beginning to see these other alternative financial markets really take off, and it turns out that they can produce quite high profits as well through such things as microfinance.
Excellent. And the final question of the day, unfortunately, I had very much wanted to ask you about humility and in listening to some prior interviews. Yes. That seemed to be a very important theme for you. So along with the reasons why that's so important for you, in addition, what do you think it's important for Americans to learn as we engage with the global community?
I think one of the ideas of the Blum Center was always to train and inspire the next generation of Americans to go out into the world and to get involved with the struggle against global poverty. But it was also important to do so with humility. The honorary chair of our board of trustees is His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And I think it's a good lesson to learn from his work as well. So I think our students do a brilliant job of being humble as they go out into the world. But I think we also need to be humble in our role as researchers and academics. I'm always humbled as a professor by the sheer enthusiasm of my students and what I learn from them. I think this is a unique moment for Americans to redefine their relationship with the world, and many of us were quite inspired by the speech that President Obama gave at Cairo, at Cairo University, in fact, because I think it charted a new way of being in the world for Americans.
Our thanks to Ananya Roy, Education Director at the Blum Center for Developing Economies and Professor in the Development of City and Regional Planning at UC Berkeley. We also thank our audiences here on the radio, television, and the internet. I'm Gina Bellaria, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.